Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to dual casualty mode of Midrats this fine June. If I sound a little different, that's because I am, well, literally in this case, phoning it in. Internet connection down where I am, so I'm relying on the good graces of AT&T in order to dial in. Eagle One, however, is still in the 21st century, so hopefully you'll get better response from him. And if you're up on the chat room today, Eagle One will be riding herd on that solo. If you have any ideas or comments going forward, not only is that the place to do it, but here's an extra special opportunity for you. It seems that our guest today is also suffering the tyranny of distance, and is not going to be able to join us. But what we decided to do today is we're going to do a little bit of a blended show where we're Eagle One and I are going to do one of our little free-for-all chat sessions to start it off. But I know that a lot of y'all came in today hoping to hear some thoughts on China. And back in January, we did a show with a couple of returning guests, Toshi Yoshihari and Jim Holmes, to discuss China. I figured that would be a good opportunity to play that again. It's definitely best of material, but we didn't want to cheat everybody and have you show up live and us not be here. So thank you very much for coming in. Also, if you would like to take a swing in the dark before we shift over onto the pre-recorded portion of the show, if you'd like to call in and throw a question at Eagle One or myself, you can call us at area code 347-308-8397. If you're up on the show page, you'll see that number right there, but I'll repeat it again. 347-308-8397. Now let's get on with the show. And when we realized our guest wasn't going to make it, I kind of rolled an idea towards Eagle One. He said, oh, well, why not? So we'll give it a shot. What we're going to do is I picked two topics that were close to my heart today, and Eagle One's going to do it as well, and we're just going to chat it up a bit. And the first thing that came to mind is when I brought up when my internet was still working, usually when I see somebody's won an election that has an intentional bruise on their forehead and looks like a character from, I guess, the people who would keep company with orcs, not good news, and that is the result of last year's Arab Spring, and now has turned into the Muslim Brotherhood, which, as we discussed when this was all taking place, with the fall of the Mubarak regime, there was only one entity that really was ready to step into the breach and assume power, and that was the Muslim Brotherhood. And there's still a fair bit of debate about what that means for the long-term national security issues of this nation and our ally Israel across the Sinai. But it's generally regarded not to be good news. You don't need to know Arabic to read what the Muslim Brotherhood is about. No reason to go over it again here. We can all Google. But when they say things like, you know, next year in Jerusalem, which is usually the phrase of our Jewish friends, that's something of concern. Also this week, there are over a little bit under 200 rockets that came in from Gaza, which has become almost as normal as the sun coming up and sun going down. So what I wanted to throw my co-host away, Eagle One, is a couple people have raised the issue out in the media. Is it well past the time that we need to reconsider the amount of economic and military assistance that we're giving Egypt, which is in essence giving the Muslim Brotherhood now, or would that be a counterproductive act that might close some avenues of discussion for obvious reasons, the Suez Canal and everything else, they could strike back at us if that's what they wanted to do. What's your thoughts, Eagle One?
It's a tough issue because, as usual, there are more bad consequences and unintended consequences whatever direction we go. If we continue the funding levels, then we are supporting people who are the sworn enemies of our allies and perhaps of ourselves. And if we don't continue the funding, as you point out, that they've got a pretty big hammer that they can lay down on us. So, you know, it's one of those ones. I think probably you maintain a course that we're currently following until you have a reason to bite the bullet and say, okay, well, we just can't go on this way because of, and you hope to use the money as a lever with the people who really count in Egypt right now, which seems to be the military, to keep them from doing anything totally out of whack. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think that's probably the wisest path to take for exactly the reason you said. You know, the law of unintended consequences, and why go ahead and bring forward a crisis where one, in theory, doesn't exist yet or isn't that bad yet. Let see how things develop, how things go forward, and if it all falls apart, then hopefully we've got smart people right now that have got their main plan, their branch plans, and their sequels up and running and outlined and planned, so we can react in a positive manner. I think probably a mistake on our part would be to try to excessively influence events there. We just don't have a good track record of trying to be, to use that horrible word, proactive, so to speak. This might be one of those situations that it is best to be reactionary. So support Israel as best as we can, make it be obvious that we will back Israel if needed, and hopefully let Egypt worry about its internal problems, because it does have huge, huge internal problems from an education and a demographic point of view. And it's not an easy fix if it can be fixed. I think the biggest impact, and you could probably remember this better than I do, but the last time the Suez Canal was closed, it didn't do anybody globally any good. And with the economic underpinnings not really firm right now, the last thing we need is a situation that impacts the Suez Canal and potentially the other sea lines of communication coming from the world's gas station, so to speak.
Yeah, again, the Europeans who are most dependent on the trade that comes through the Suez Canal will be the ones who would take the heaviest hit. And it's such a horrible time right now for their economies. And I'm not saying that that's not somewhat brought on by themselves, but that would just be one more nail in the coffin. And I don't think that would be really a good thing right now. Yeah, you know, the for us, for the U.S., Canada, and some of the other countries in the Western Hemisphere, it may be that if the Suez Canal were closed, that it would prompt some further development of the natural resources we already have. And while I'm not convinced that self-sustaining, you know, having our own energy source is totally ideal, at least it might help us along the path of developing the resources we already have. Man, back to you.
Yeah, I don't know if our buddy Claude is up in the chat room or not, but when you look, and we'll come around to my second topic after we let you throw up your first topic here. I'll take one more swing around the poll here. Is when you look at what potentially could happen in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood type of government, and goodness knows what's going to happen in Yemen coming up here. You have two very young and almost medievally poor nations straddling that part of the world. you know, people think history gets boring, or all the world's history is going to be in China and Western Pacific. I think might have a rude awakening down the road. There'll be no shortage of additional news coming from the Red Sea area, I think, is one way of putting it. That's about where I am here. Is I don't like what I'm seeing. There's nothing springtime about it, but sometimes the world is what it is. You just have to accept it and try to mitigate its impact on you.
Yeah, Saturn 5 posed a good question in the chat room, which you can't see, but it he asks, is it possible that USA's almost unconditional backing of Israel plays in the hands or into the hands of the fundamentalist actors like the Muslim Brotherhood? And, you know, I guess it seems like we almost are unconditionally supportive of Israel, but given that they've been one of our best allies in a world that's been surrounded by people getting arms from what was at the time and may still remain our arch enemy in the world at the time, Russia, and now some of those countries are getting, like Syria, have been getting aid from China, among other people. I'm not sure that the backing of Israel alone is one of the factors. When I lived in Turkey, I don't think the Turks especially held our support of Israel against us, because they too had a support. I mean, you know, there's a balancing act that's being done by all those countries along the periphery of the Mediterranean Sea, and it would be unfortunate if it's more difficult to maintain the balancing act than if it's not. And I hope that we pursue a political agenda which allows for everybody to feel like if we don't support them all equally, at least we're not trying to undermine them at any given minute. So that's a tough one to handle.
Yeah,
any
I
thoughts
think,
on that?
Yeah, I sure do. And this sounds a little harsh on my part, but frankly, I don't give a damn what the rest of the world thinks about our relationship with Israel. There are certain facts that they are what they are. Israel is a very, very small country on the Mediterranean. When Israel was created, it was desert, underutilized. It was a backwater of the Syrian province of the Ottoman Empire. They have turned it in the last few decades into what is in a sea of misery in that part of the world, what is something akin to California. It's democratic. It's progressive. It has a dynamic economy. And you could also look at, that's just from my point of view, it is a Western outpost of liberty and freedom and just a sewage of tyranny in that part of the world. And on top of it, there's a historical reason. Besides a couple of villages in northern Iraq, the Assyrians are gone. All these other people have gone thousands of years. The Jews are still with us. And besides the United States, every other country they've tried to live in has either slaughtered them wholesale or kicked them out. You can look at the Jews that used to be all the way from Morocco to Iran and what's happened to them in the last 50 years. I don't care if every single nation in that part of the world became our enemy. It would be an immoral act, I think, of the first degree to abandon what is really the only country in that part of the world that has decades of records, imperfect here and there, no less imperfect than ours, of Western progressive democratic thought. And again, going back to historical place, the Jewish people should be allowed to have the home that they had up until the Romans scattered everybody. And if the rest of the world doesn't like it because Israel, in the course of half a century, created California, where the other people in that part of the world could barely control malaria, and they live in these backwards, dusty, hate-strewn cities, that's not Israel's fault. Those people should look at internally at their own problems and their own faults, as opposed to looking at this little sliver of land between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean that makes them feel guilty because it's a success. So that's my unbiased opinion on the state of Israel.
Kind of funny ironic that the question comes from Turkey, because that is the other longstanding democracy, although, you know, it's been up and down sometimes, but longstanding democracy in that area. And, you know, that I think that it was one of the things that used to unite Turkey and Israel a little bit. Turkey used to, and perhaps still does, allow the Israeli cruise ships and all that stuff to come into their ports. You know, I think there was a relationship there. It's too bad that would have been broken down, but it wasn't broken down because of U.S. support for Israel necessarily. I mean, there are a lot of other factors involved, and it was take too long, and it probably is another show or two on how that mess got there. But it's a complicated issue. Let me throw a question at you. Not to segue too abruptly, but and you can keep going whenever you want. But there was a letter that was in the U.S. Naval Institute blog, and I'll put a link up to it here in a minute in the chat room, to Admiral Greenert from Representative Randy Forbes about the fleet, about calling, asking the questions which need to be asked. Are you serious? Are we really putting warfighting first and then shrinking our fleet to 280 ships or whatever it is these days? And how are we doing this? What is going on? And I think you've had a chance to read that now. What are your thoughts on that letter?
I think you got a couple things going here. Our fleet size, you know, as you and I have talked over the years, I think we've both been blogging about it for over half a decade. It reaches a point that the facts override the PowerPoint slides, and we've reached that in the last couple of years. But our fleet size is baked into the cake because in the previous decade, decisions were made that we needed to have the perfect be the goal. I've called it the Tiffany Navy. Amphibious ships are great, but when you make a decision that you want titanium fire mains, and you're going to have all these great expenses to produce a, quote, stealth warship, unquote, but when you actually have to add the things that make a ship, it kind of goes out the corner, not to mention the fact there's a cost-benefit analysis and everything. So you have amphibious ships that are almost too exquisite, too expensive, and carry too much men and materiel that you don't want to get it close to the shore, because if you lose one of them, then you only have a couple, three there, then you have operational risk. If you lose two, you go to strategic risk. We decided that we needed a land attack destroyer, so we built something the size of the pocket battleship Graf Spee that actually has a larger visual imprint than even the Graf Spee did, and it's affordable. We decided we needed a small warship, so we built something the size of a World War II destroyer, called it Littoral Combat, and then we're in this big argument, well, we don't want to put it in combat because it's a little too fragile, and somebody else says, well, it needs to go into the littorals because it's so shallow, it can go places no one else can, which I've always found has been a ridiculous, and it needs to go there at 50 knots, so you have that engineering cost there. And here we come into the headwinds of a financial crisis brought on about the unsustainability of the Western welfare state that is going to have an economic impact on defense budgets, whether you like it or not. Follow Gallarin's tweet. He put up a post to an article that I'm kind of torqued off that I missed. You know, the Brits are looking at closing down the Portsmouth shipyard, something that's been going since the late Middle Ages. And that is a direct result of their budgetary problems, and we're just 5 to 10 years behind them. So we've decided to put forward shipbuilding programs of extremely expensive ships in a headwind of an economic and budgetary reality, which is going to be smaller budgets. That will directly result in smaller ships, break. But what also plays into that is we took away some of the bridging capabilities we have had in the last 5 years And when you talk to people who actually looked at the ships, they probably wouldn't have made it past 30 anyway because of the fact we weren't taking care of them. But we retired a lot of ships early, earlier than we should have, saying, well, we're going to recapitalize and use that cost savings to buy DDG-1000s, to buy more LCS. So we no longer have those ships that we retired early, whether you're talking about the Spruances, that we still would have had a few more lying around now if we had done what could have been done with those ships, or the early run of the Ticonderoga class cruisers, which we could have gotten more time out of. I appreciate what Randy Forbes is saying and kind of putting Admiral Greener on a report to a certain extent, but I don't see any more money coming out of Congress. And the fix to having a more affordable fleet, we don't even have anything on the drawing board. The answer to everything seems to be Flight 3 of the Arleigh Burke, which is a great ship, but it's a little long in the tooth, I think. We've lost some opportunities there, and I think we're just at a kind of a moment in floating between situations where the great dreams of the previous decade of this beautiful fleet is not really playing out. We're not going to be able to afford it. And the following question is like, okay, that's what is going on. We can know the so what, which is now we're going to have a smaller fleet. What next? What is next? What is the Navy's plan to actually have a fleet that gives the component commanders the Navy they need to create the effects that they need forward, and can be done in an affordable manner, and can be done in a numbers basis, which actually makes it useful. There's some ludicrous things coming out of the Beltway about how these three Zumwalt class DDG-1000s, all these great things it can do in the Western Pacific. It takes three to make one, two to make one. You're not going to do that with three ships. There's some great long-term technology things we can probably derive from that class of ships. But I'm waiting for the what next. Have you seen the plan for the what next, or are we just waiting for somebody to come forward with a catalyst that we can start talking about the what next? Because right now I just think we're stuck.
No, I haven't seen the plan for the what next, and basically that's what Randy Forbes is asking about. You know, we announced a pivot to one of the hardest or longest distance areas for us to get to. We postulate putting some of the LCSs on a short-term basis in Singapore, maybe the Philippines. But it begs a bigger question. I think John Conrad from he'll kill me. I forgot the name of his blog, but you know, we all blogged on the rise of this maritime surveillance service of the Chinese, which
right.
appears to have
G-Captain.
They're going to have more, G-Captain. Thank you. They're going to have more ships than our Navy does, and you know, it is a matter of in an area where presence is going to matter. And the other guy is going to have a presence because he's close by that's much larger than yours, and we're going to, you know, throw out four, five, six ships and have a, you know, force in Japan, maybe in a force on Guam. You know, sometimes visibility is important. Sometimes that visibility means you have to put more ships in that area, and that means you have to have more ships. And I just, you know, I think we've done some good things. I think the move of Marines into Australia is good. I have no problem with a force in Singapore or the Philippines, wherever we can put some ships. I'm just not sure that particular ship or the numbers of those ships is so impressive that it's going to make a difference to anybody in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I don't think it is. And plus, the historian in me doesn't like the idea of having poorly armed ships in Singapore or anywhere between in the Taiwan, Indonesia, Philippine triangle there, because any land-based air power will eliminate them in no time flat. I'm much happier if we're going to have fleet units them a little further back, whether we're talking about Hawaii or Australia. I think the larger, the better, the more arrive, alive, arrive, ready to go, multi-mission, larger sized ships is the way to go, along the reason the great success of our fleet submarines in World War II was their size, because they were designed around the challenges of the Pacific. Now, what is that ship that you want cruising around that part of the world? If I hear one more person talk about a fast, shallow ship is great, my head's going to explode. Because think about, while you were off Vietnam, we had heavy cruisers and destroyers within pissing distance of the shore. You can't get any more littoral than that. You look at the Guadalcanal campaign, the Solomon Islands, everything in that area. Very large ships can create effects very close to shore and still be survivable on it. Four ships in Singapore are pretty good for port visits, pretty good for fleet weeks. Sailors are going to have a great time. Probably the longer they're in Singapore, the better. You know, go up to Hong Kong, the great hosts up there. But actually impressing anybody? No. I don't think that's really going to impress anybody. What we did last year, where we had, was it, four of our SSGNs go, "Well, hi, everybody, how you doing? We're from Diego Garcia to Japan this week. Hope you're having a nice day." That, I think, puts the message that you want to have out there.
Yeah, and I'm curious. I mean, as a surface guy, I tend to think of surface ships, but, you know, I am certainly convinced that we don't have enough submarines, and among all the other things we don't have enough of, that one strikes me as being really, really important in a world where, when you're talking anti-access, anti-denial, it's really nice to be able to call on something that is pretty darn hard to locate and do anything about. I'm a big fan of the Ohio-class SSGNs, I guess they are, and I would love to have more of those in our fleet. I don't know how complicated that is, or you know how hard that would be. And I can't help but believe, in a time of a bad economy, that building up some ships and stuff doesn't help the growth internally of our shipyards and hundreds of people, if not thousands, throughout the country.
It doesn't hurt, and it also maintains an industrial base and a technology base that there's more to it than, you know, the cost of your ships. I think the Germans have been pretty good about that, especially their submarines are always really young. It's not because they don't last long, it's because they want to keep their submarine capability up and running, and nobody builds a better non-nuclear submarine than the Germans, except maybe the Japanese. But funny, let's see if people come together now and then. But not as much as you used to. I was about to say, well, you have a really good support with the congressional delegation in the Northeast. Maybe not as much as you used to. But Electric Boat in Connecticut, they do quality work. I think you've got, just like our buddies up at BIW, Bath Iron Works, if we can't keep things going enough, that should be the last shipyard we close, is up at BIW. There's something about building a ship when it's 10 below zero that makes a quality unit. But that, I think that's something else. Obviously, Representative Forbes, being from Virginia, you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a dry dock there, and that's nice, actually. But I think there's some local politics, but there's also some smart economics involved in it, too. You look at the billions and billions of dollars that we spent in stimulus that fried air, it's gone. There's nothing there that you can put to it. Then you look at the money that was invested in USS Enterprise and what it produced over 50 years for payback to the taxpayer. It's pretty darn impressive. Let me ask you this, Eagle One, while we're speaking of Representative Forbes, he has been pretty active, and Mackenzie Eglin that we had on a while ago, we asked her about it as well. People in Congress who are military-minded that we can rely on to ask questions, like you can find over at USNI blog that he wrote to Admiral Greenert. Have you seen anybody recently that is even pacing what Representative Forbes is doing from a being out there in public point of view?
You know, Elijah Cummings, a Democrat, I think, from Maryland, has been really good on the Coast Guard issues. I mean, he's been all over Coast Guard stuff. Otherwise, as far as naval issues go, you know, I other than Randy Forbes, I'm not really familiar with him, and I guess maybe some congressmen from Mississippi. and a couple probably in Southern California where the some of the MSC ships are being built. I really am not too familiar with people who are saying, you know, hey, we – and I think that's the fault of big Navy. You know, I don't think we've sold the fast attack submarine thing very well. The public doesn't know what they do. and you know, we when they do, I mean, there's a new TV show coming out where I think FBM – is somehow going to go rogue and take over an island. And, I mean, it just sounds awful from the get go. But you know, when everything you know about the military is from movies like Crimson Tide and Under Siege or no, what's the one where the battleship with the cook who's a SEAL. So I can't remember the movie, but you know, if that's everything you know, instead of going to watch Act of Valor, and instead of talking to you know real Navy people about what real Navy things do, you know, like we don't fight aliens, we got enough other issues. So battleship is you know is another one of those things where we're gonna get the wrong idea, and you know we need to do our Navy needs to do a better job of selling what the Navy does and why we do it and all that. And I know they've tried. You know, Lord knows we've seen enough of the PowerPoint presentations and the impressive music that sounded like it came out of Pirates of the Caribbean or something. But we've got to do a much better job of saying, look, America, this is really important. We're an island nation, if you will, and we got two oceans that we need to protect, and those distances shrink pretty quickly in modern warfare. So you know, we need to really get out there and do a better job. And I'm afraid we don't.
Yeah, I think we have a couple of lost opportunities here. You know, in Congress, to be an advocate, you know, a congressman's not going to go out there and to use a colloquial term, going to show his ass. You know, he wants to make sure he knows this stuff before he goes out and speaks about it. Senator Webb, wow, what a lost opportunity there he could have been for the Navy. And then you had Sestak, say what you want to about him. Goodness knows I did over the years. But politics aside, he could have been a great advocate for a lot of the things in the Navy. But, again, lost opportunity. He can best speak to why, just like James Wegg could best speak to why he never perhaps did more things for the Navy, or at least to raise the profile than otherwise took place. It was a huge lost opportunity. But I think a lot of it also has to do with there was over at Small Wars Journal.
Now you're going to get me singing that stupid theme song in my head, you know.
Well, it is a world of laughter and a world of tears. We covered here every week on Midrats. There's an article, you know, one of the Dear Boss letters by a Air Force JO who's just fed up and quit walking away. And I wonder if part of that has to do with something we've lamented here with our guest a few times, is the whole post-Goldwater Nichols mentality of our senior leaderships makes, with the exception of the Marines, makes a lot of them very hesitant to go out there, get the Navy drum out there, and beat it louder than anybody else next to them. Everybody wants to be congenial. Everybody wants to be purple. Everybody wants to, you know, get it, come along with the team, et cetera, and so forth. And we don't have a real outgoing advocate like that. Now, I'm trying to think of when we did. You know, am I lamenting a time that never was? But I'm a post Goldwater Nichols guy. That's the reality that I lived in. And as a JO, and you, it didn't just apply to the aviators either. Tail hook happened while I was a JG. And you talk about a bunch of people sticking their heads in. There had been a lot of withdrawing from the public in some areas, besides some very good Broward County Fleet Week excursions that we won't discuss in mixed company. But how much do you think that has to do with it, the Goldwater Nichols, everybody's joint lack of advocacy?
You know, I think it's important, but I think the one of the problems we had was we're coming off 10 years of ground war. And before that, with Desert Storm, it was another ground war, although the seagoing logistics were a huge part of it. I don't think the Navy did a very good job after that war, and certainly not during over the last 10 years. We just haven't done a very good job of selling is what we do and why we're important. And, I think we're paying the price for that. But I'm always hoping to hear another stuff, so.
Well, if we're going to play our pre-recorded part, we should probably wind it up here pretty soon. Did you cover the two questions you wanted to? We kind of covered my second question I wanted to talk about was the Syrian shootdown of the Turkish F-4. Did you get to your second question?
I think I covered it. My question was really kind of a combined thing where I was going to play off that letter from to Greenert and talk about our warfighting capacity, but I think I ranted on that enough already. So what's your question?
Well, the question I had for you is there was a lot of heavy breathing about the Syrians shooting down the F-4 by the Turks, which I think everybody went, F-4s are still flying? Yep, there are still F-4s flying. The ironic thing about the Turkish F-4 is they were upgraded by Israel. So they're pretty top-notch aircraft, even though they are pretty long in the tooth. And it originally looked like Syria said, I'm sorry, and Turkey went, that's okay, things happen. But then the Turks kind of rattled their sabers, because I think they had to. In that part of the world, you kind of look umbrage. But I don't think anything is going to happen from it, simply because the Turks don't want any part of that. NATO is not going to back Turkey's play, I don't think. I don't see anybody wanting to engage in that Syrian conflict, besides maybe sending some arms to some Syrians to fight it out, because I don't think anybody wants the blood on their hands, because it's just, regardless of who winds up coming on top in that situation, it's going to be bloody. And you don't want to be the person who is in charge of the 19-year-old young man with a gun standing on the crossroads trying to keep peace in Syria, because it's just going to get ugly.
Yeah, I see Saturn V is typing away on something to do with this, I'm sure. But, I've been surprised at how reticent Turkey has been to get involved. It's on their back door. I assume they're getting the refugees. It stirs up some of their internal problems with the Kurds. Saturn V says that was an RF-4E. It was not modernized by Israel.
Oh.
So, yeah. So there, get it right.
Everybody has said F-4. Now, the F-4s were modernized by Israel. The RF-4s were not.
He says that. He says the F-4Es were modified, but not the RF-4E. And RF means, to me, means reconnaissance, right?
Yeah, photo reconnaissance. The Marine, I think the last RF-4 squadron we had was the Marine squadron in the first Gulf War. I had a very urbane and civilized Turkish naval captain I worked with, who spoke with a perfect British accent. It's kind of unnerving. But he was definitely somebody from Constantinople. And we were talking about Syria. This must have been 4 years ago, over a beer, of all things. And he said, you know what, we don't want them. We did not like them when they were a province of the Ottoman Empire. We just want anything to do with them. I don't think the Turkish people want anything to do with the Syrians or any of their territory. They probably just wish they would keep their nastiness on their side of the border and bleed it out on their own.
Well, you know, and it's just the friends of the Syrians you got to deal with. So and who are their friends? Well, we got Russia, who's on the other side of Turkey too, and we got Iran, and we got China. And I cannot imagine that looks like, you know, a really pleasant place to start poking your stick. It's kind of like finding that lovely old hornet's nest, you know, hanging from a tree and deciding to poke at it. You know, I think I would accept the apology for the downing of my RF-4E and build a better fence. But
get the better ECM gear on your RF-4. We'll chalk it up to a. The good thing is both the Turkish pilot and the Rio, or the reconnaissance officer, whatever they call them, they were both picked out of the water pretty well. So, bravo Zulu to the rescue team that they were on the spot like that. So, I think that was a good demonstration of professionalism by the Turks right there, because there are very few nations out there that if you're a pilot and you get smashed and you punch out, that your countrymen will show up in a helo in a timely manner and take your wet bohunkus home. And so good job on the Turk search and rescue team. They did a good job.
Yeah, Saturn V notes that Syria is a proxy power struggle between Turkey and Iran, and I think that's probably right. And you know, if you're fighting with proxies, you don't want to get your own hands involved in wet work. So and I think you've confirmed. And he also has asked whether those guys were rescued. And the answer is yes, they were rescued.
All is good. Well, hey, I guess this will be the end of our live portion here. Next week, we're going to have a best of for July 4th weekend, being that's what most people are celebrating, July 4th weekend. And then we're going to come back in with our live programs. Any last words for everybody, Igor?
No, I apologize to people for the difficulty with our guests. I put the advertisements out on like the USNI blog, but what we need to do, I think, we down the road when we get a chance, and I know we got a pretty busy schedule for the next few weeks, but we do need to bring up this issue with Turkey and Iran and Syria and that whole mess in there. So, again, Saturn V is, by the way, is asking to confirm that those guys were rescued. So you're sure they got plucked out of whatever mess they were in?
I read two articles that said that they were. Maybe the articles were incorrect. That's been known to happen. But that was, the day that it happened, there were two articles I read that said that they were rescued. So initial reports and second reports can be wrong. At least I hope they were.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to take you at your last word. And Ken Adams, though, says BBC has no news of that as of 1743 Eastern U.S. time. But anyway, for those of you who were joining us to hear about the Eastern approaches to China, we apologize for that, but we are going to offer up a former, previously aired show, as they say on Car Talk, featuring a couple of Naval War College experts, and we hope that'll satisfy your China craving for the day.
Have a great week. Cheers, everybody.
We have Toshi Yoshihara and James Holmes as our guests. They are both associate professors over at the Naval War College in sunny Newport. And just as a reminder for those that are joining us live, if you could, we have the show page, and at the bottom you're going to find the chat room. And at the chat room, you're going to find our usual suspects. So fold in with them. If you have some observations and some comments you'd like to make about the show as we go on, or if there's a question that you would like for us to approach our guests with, please hop in. We'll both be up on the chat room. We'll try to fold that in as soon as possible. And always, I want to extend an invitation to those who are new to MidRats or have only caught a couple of our shows. You can get the archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can set yourself up to get the podcast on iTunes. So let's get on with the show. Toshi and Jim, welcome to MidRats.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Hey, I wanted to start off, first of all, wanted to congratulate both of you on your book, and this is the reason why. A lot of the recent books coming out on China, they can be a little heavy, they can be a little dense, and some of it is just a conglomeration of various other items. But in your book, Red Star Over the Pacific, it's a real tight 224 pages, very approachable. So congratulations on being able to get the world's largest country into 224 pages.
Thanks. I think we have a real shortage of books about that size these days. If you look back at a lot of the classics in international relations, which is what Toshi and I specialize in, a lot of the great works like Diplomacy by Harold Nicholson are 100, 150 pages long, and they managed to compress a whole lot of content into just a few pages. So I hope we did as well.
What are you trying to with this book? What are you trying to put together, and what would you really want the reader to focus on?
Well, I think one of the key points, one of our key purposes for the volume is to try to convey the idea that China's rise as a sea power is not going to be a temporary phenomenon, but rather it's going to be a sustained challenge to U.S. maritime strategy in Asia. Because the Chinese are growing along multiple vectors, both in terms of their intellectual capacity to think about the seas, their material capabilities, but also in terms of their grand strategy, in terms of their diplomatic strategies in East Asia, in Southeast Asia, in South Asia. So this is going to be, I think, a sustained growth of the Chinese. It's not going to be something that will end anytime soon, and we hope that this book makes that point very clear, that this challenge, although subtle in certain aspects, it is here to stay.
In your recent article in Naval Institute Proceedings about China, and you're suggesting that there might be a turn to Julian Corbett, being a naval strategist, along with Alfred Mahan or Mahan, depending on where you're from. Could you discuss just shortly, kind of give the listeners a brief introduction to Mahan and to Corbett, and discuss where China is going with that and how that fits into the strategic picture as you all see it?
Jim, why don't you take that?
And you have 30 seconds, Dan.
Oh, in 30 seconds. Whoa, okay. Mahan in 30 seconds.
I'm just.
Well, Mahan's, if you ever look at Mahan's bibliography done by John Hattendorf, our historian at the college, just his bibliography is well over 100 pages. So reducing him to 30 seconds is not easy. We've advanced the argument over the last few years that, and we look to another one of our. One of our deities at the Naval War College, Carl von Clausewitz, who proposes that that essentially there's a logic and then there's a grammar of strategy in politics. The logic furnishing the very high level sort of the ethereal guidance for strategy, and then obviously the grammar being the stuff that we're used to thinking about, force structure and doctrine and all that sort of thing. What we've argued is that that China tends to look at Mahan, and they talk about Mahan all the time. But they look at him for the logic, for the very high level guidance into what navies are for. Why do we need sea power? Mahan proposes that commerce is king. This is really what drives sea power. The three elements of sea power are commerce, implying domestic production, and also naval and merchant shipping, and then bases, overseas naval stations of some sort to support the operations of fleets. And I think they've really internalized that. What we've tried to start getting into with the China and Corbett piece in the Naval Institute proceedings that you mentioned is, we've been expecting for some time for the Chinese to start widening their view of Mahan, and to start looking at other theorists and to start trying to weave them into an overall Chinese theory of sea power. They started off with Mahan. Well, we started looking at this back in 2004. They pretty much started off with Mahan's definition of command of the sea, which is very bloody-minded, overbearing power, that drives an enemy's flag from vital waters, or at most allows it to appear as a fugitive. That was pretty much the sum total of Chinese understanding of Mahan in those days. But they've started reading more widely. They've read more of his works, and they're factoring that into their strategic thought now. And they're starting to look at other theorists like Corbett. To us, if you ever read Corbett, he functions mostly down on the grammatical level, using the Clausewitzian construct I put out a minute ago. And he talks a lot. He talks about active defense. He talks about using fleets very offensively, even in pursuit of defensive aims. This, to me, if you took Corbett's name off his book and you read it not knowing who the author was, you might actually think it was a Chinese scholar at times, because it almost sounds like Mao's notion of active defense, which he obviously fashioned for land warfare, but then the Chinese are now applying that to the sea. So it just seemed like Corbett was a natural fit for the Chinese, and so we weren't surprised to see them start turning to Corbett, but we did want to get the word out as they start doing this.
You, Jim, maybe this is one of your areas of specialty, India. Maybe this would be something to toss into your lap. But as China grows, whether you're looking at it from an economic point of view or just because of their sheer size, when people are comparing the growth of China, you know, pretty soon the conversation comes towards the growth of India, especially since they've started to move away from Fabian socialism, and you're seeing some improvement on their growth rates. And one thing that kind of sticks out about India is when you look at the various places that China is reaching out to in order to get access to the resources and the raw material in order to maintain their economy and to keep producing things at the below market prices, get jobs for their people, etc. It's through the Indian Ocean. So obviously that concern and that focus on India, you not only have that land border, but you also have that sea border. How do the Indians view China's rise in some ways different than the Americans are?
We actually appreciate you steering in that direction, because Toshi and I and another colleague have done, we've actually written a book a few years ago, or I guess it was 2-3 years ago now, on the Indian Navy and the rise of India. And obviously, as you hinted at, a huge part of that is geared to China, to what China's naval ambitions might be in the Indian Ocean. It feels a little bit strange. India is obviously a big democracy, but very unruly. There are different factions saying all different things at any given time. The Indian Navy seems, for obvious reasons, very tunnel visioned on the Chinese threat. I'll just offer one small example that makes up a lot of the discourse on China in the Indian Ocean: the notion of a string of pearls. This was a notion that came out of a Booz Allen study about 5 years ago, but basically the notion that China had embarked on a quest for a Mahanian base network. Remember, that's one of the elements of Mahanian sea power. Basically looking for these forward naval stations in the Indian Ocean. So this term string of pearls comes out of the United States, is immediately seized on by the Indians, and pretty much taken as gospel. Even today, a lot of the naval commentators and the military commentators will say as fact that China is doing this. It is looking for bases like comparable to our own base network in the Western Pacific and Hawaii and so forth. And that's obviously a troubling thing for the Navy, which has to worry about Indian maritime security. India, strangely, Toshi and I have found that, I studied things like the Monroe Doctrine and Mahan and stuff like that when I was in graduate school, just because I was interested in it. But these are things that people in these rising sea powers are reading a lot. India sees itself as number one in the Indian Ocean, and Indian leaders will explicitly cite the Monroe Doctrine as a precedent for Indian foreign policy. So if you think about how the United States looked at European powers in the Western Hemisphere 100 years ago, transpose that to the Indian Ocean today, that gives you some sense of how Indians think about encroachment of powers like China in their own backyard. So clearly within naval circles and military circles, China is job number one. When you move up into the political realm, obviously that's you're going to get a lot of different viewpoints. But clearly within the Indian Armed Forces, China is number one. Hey, Tush, you want to add to that? Did I skip anything
sure.
important?
Yeah, I think it's also important to note that there is sort of mutual suspicion that's animating Sino-Indian relations. Just as some Indians tend to interpret the worst of intentions from the Chinese think the same way about the Indians. They are convinced that the Indians do in fact have blue water ambitions and that they intend to extend their naval reach in concentric rings well into China's own backyard, particularly in the South China Sea. And there are many Chinese commentators who argue that New Delhi's look east policy, which is more of a broader political economic strategy in East Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, they not only see that as a political economic strategy, but they also interpret it as a military strategy designed to tie down the Chinese. Some commentators, for example, say that part of India's look east policy is specifically to develop strategic relations with Vietnam. That would then serve to sort of force the Chinese to concentrate its attention in Southeast Asia and particularly in the South China Sea so that it will not have the energy to look farther west into the Indian Ocean. So I think there's a very interesting dynamic here where both sides, I think, look at each other very warily. And I think this is going to be part of the ingredients that's going to fuel this very sort of quiet competition in the maritime domain.
Yeah, although a lot of Chinese maritime thinkers do take a rather dismissive view of the Indian of the Indian comprehensive national power, economic growth, and this and whatnot, but also specifically of the Indian Navy. It does seem that China does feel a little bit conflicted about India. On the very high level, they understand that India is a country on the move and it has grand ambitions, but they simply doubt that that India will be able to follow through on it in material terms anytime soon.
Right, and I think what's interesting about that is that there's sort of a hierarchy of condescension in maritime relations. The way the Chinese speak about Indian naval power is almost very similar to the way the United States looked at Chinese naval power about 10 years ago, when people talked about China's coercive option against Taiwan as being a million-man swim. That type of condescension, I think, still characterizes some of Chinese commentary about Indian material capabilities at sea. But I think it is also worth observing, perhaps down the road, that there might be an inflection point where the Chinese begin to reassess Indian naval power, just as Americans have recently begun to reassess Chinese naval power in the Western Pacific.
Right.
Eagle One?
Well, let me shift the focus for a second to a different part of Asia. I was listening to an interview with Dr. Henry Kissinger that somebody in the Wall Street Journal did, and they asked him what the major concerns in our relationship with China would be. And much to my surprise, rather than mentioning Taiwan, he went first to North Korea. Can you guys, do you have a feel for that? How does that fit into this? And where does Chinese naval power fit into that sort of situation?
Well, I think there tends to be sort of, myopia about the cross-strait relationship. You know, I think a lot of the commentary tends to surround the most recent trends and the most recent events that dictate cross-strait relations. But I think that we've seen pendulum swings to more crisis-prone situations and then to more stable situations. So just because things have gotten, towards more stability in the past 2 years does not mean that that relationship will, in fact, shift back to a more crisis-prone situation. And I think one of the wild cards here is Taiwan's politics. That's something that neither the United States nor China can control. So I think there's no way of knowing how the elections in Taiwan in 2012 will turn out to be. And if that's the case, if the Taiwanese elect a leader that the Chinese consider to be unfavorable to Chinese policy, I think it's very possible that we could swing back to the kind of language that we saw from the Chinese in 2000, where you could get a sense that the Chinese leadership did not feel that time was on its side and therefore was prepared to pressure the Taiwanese to try to resolve their disputes. And so I think even though things look good now, I would not foreclose the possibility that things could in fact go badly in the coming years. And in that sense, I think that the Chinese are continuing to build up their deterrent force across the island as they basically as a strategic hedge against that potential eventuality or possibility. And so, again, I wouldn't write off the Taiwan situation as something that will be secure on an indefinite basis.
Yeah, one of our very first essays that we did together, and I think it was in the Naval War College Review in the 2005 timeframe. We had some fun with it. We went back and looked at the Peloponnesian War, the Great War between Athens and Sparta 2,500 years ago, which involved island warfare, and we essentially said that China's strategy, China's not building up all this